You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Like, I remember a couple shagging up the back during, like, a morning showing of Horton Hears a Who. And I was like, why? This is not what Dr. Seuss would want.
Welcome to Midnight Chats, a podcast of laid-back conversations with leading names in music. In keeping with these informal interviews, each new one is published weekly at midnight. This week's episode is hosted by me, Greg Cochran, from Loud and Quiet magazine. Tonight, my guest on the podcast is Lauren Mabry, singer, multi-instrumentalist and songwriter with the band Churches. It's been a decade since Lauren came together with Martin Doherty and Ian Cook to form the synth pop trio. Previously, they'd each been part of various alt-rock projects around the Glasgow area. They released their debut album, The Bones of What You Believe, in 2013. Since then, they've gone on to become one of Britain's biggest and most uncategorisable, if that's even a word, bands, having collaborated and toured with a wide variety of artists ranging from Paramore to The National, Marshmallow to Deftones. You've no doubt heard the song they released recently here now in June 2021. It's with Robert Smith from The Cure. It's called How Not to Drown. If you haven't come across it, I've dropped a link to the video into the show notes. The tale of getting Robert involved is really, really good, and so too are some of the stories about getting to know him. Lauren talks about all of that in the chat you're about to hear. The conversation is pretty fresh, recorded just a few days ago. Thanks to Lauren, who was speaking to me from her place in Los Angeles. We were joined at the start by her cat, the excellently named Cactus. And Lauren was really generous with her time, a really open person to speak to, so thank you to her. We covered loads of ground in this, including the pressures and the perils of the internet, particularly if you're a woman fronting a band, and all the toxic stuff that she has been subjected to. Her days working in the local cinema back in Scotland, and how that gave birth to a love of horror movies that have gone on to inform this current period of the band. And really interesting to hear her thoughts on the art versus artist debate, and where she stands on if and how those two things can be separated. For the record, I'm with her on that. And of course, we talk a bit about Church's forthcoming new album, Screen Violence, which is set to be released on the 27th of August. Just finally, excuse the very occasional interference on the mics. It's just the way these things go sometimes, doing things on opposite sides of the world. So here we go. This is Lauren Mabry from Churches on episode 111 of Midnight Chats. This episode of Midnight Chats is supported by Because Music, the record label that's home to Christine and the Queens, Django Django, Metronomy, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and many other brilliant artists. Justice are another one of those, and Because have just released the debut solo album from Gaspar Auger, who is one half of the French electronic duo. The album is called Escapades, and it's out now, something totally different from what you might expect, so do go and check check it out. You'll find it in any decent record shop or online retailer, and it's also available to download and stream now. That's Escapades by Gaspar Auger, and thanks again to Because Music.
I don't know what it is. As soon as I sit down in the office to do any kind of promotional activity, you want...
Who is this?
That was Cactus. She has a sister called Poppy, who's in the other room, doesn't care for the promo, isn't bothered. But it's just as soon as you shut the door, they think you're doing something amazing and they have to come find out.
Is she called Cactus because she has like a sort of prickly personality? Or where does that name come from?
Well, they came with the names. We got them from a rescue place and they'd already named them. But they were teeny weeny when we got them. But I think she's called Cactus because at the time she had really spiky fur. Now she's just insanely fluffy. So, yeah. And I was like, that takes the pressure off me for naming the cat. I don't feel so bad about it.
Would you have relished the challenge to name your cat, or would that have been like quite a difficult one? Because some people sort of have something like they want to name their cat after their favorite sports player or their favorite like musician or something, don't they?
But yes, I mean, I met a white cat called Steve Albino once, which I was like pretty spicy, but fair enough. But yes, I've been naming fantasy cats for like 10 years because we were on tour so much I couldn't really get a pet. But in a way, it took the responsibility away. They were like, do you want the cat or not? Like, yes. So pre-named cats, all good.
Cats are one of those pets that, when you do go on tour and it's months on end that you're away for, at least the cat is slightly, it's just like their personality is more to be independent and they're kind of, you might get home after 3 months away and you open the door and they take one look at you and just sort of shrug.
Yes, I feel less guilty. I feel like if with a dog, you'd be breaking its heart by leaving. I like to think the cats would notice insofar as they receive less treats. Because I am the active treat giver. But other than that, I think they'd be fine, which is nicer for them, I think.
Before we dive into talking about the new album, Screen Violence, 2021 is 10 years since the start of Churches,
which is
amazing, a whole decade. What are your feelings on that, reflections on that? Does a milestone like that mean anything to you, or are you not the kind of person that dwells on that type of thing?
I feel like I dwell on the passage of time a lot, especially in the last couple of years. I feel like maybe like turning 30 and maybe just everything that happened in the last 18 months for everybody makes you reflect a lot more. I kind of not even thought that it was 10 years until we started doing promo, and then people were like, did you know? It's been 10 years of your life. And honestly, it feels like I don't really remember a time where I wasn't in Churches. Insofar like emotionally, it feels like that's just been there for a long time. But also what happened to the 20s? The 20s just disappeared in a good way, doing something really amazing that so few people get to do. So I'm very lucky, but I think it'll sink in for us when it's like 10 years since the first album. It'll be weird because we haven't seen Ian in such a long time because Martin and myself are in Los Angeles and Ian's in Glasgow. So fingers crossed, in theory, we might see him before the end of the summer.
Right, that would be great, wouldn't it?
And then I think hopefully we'll be in the same place around the 10th anniversary thing, which I think will be good.
Would you get together, go to the pub and just sort of like talk about those early months or something like that? Would you mark the occasion a bit like that? Allow yourselves to be nostalgic for a night?
I think so, because when you're in the thick of it and you're just like doing it, especially like pre-2020, like there isn't a ton of time to reflect on stuff. And at least I've been bad at doing that. Not that you're not grateful for it, but I never really sat and thought about how mad a lot of the stuff that happened around our band was, just because you were just like, oh man, better take these opportunities before they go away. And we were just like running. And we knew it didn't happen a lot for people in Glasgow and where we come from, but we didn't know if that was uncommon in general. And now that I know more people in bands and how things happen for them, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't happen every day. That is quite a mental story, the way it rolled out for us. So I'm very grateful for it. I sound very wistful. I had a whole year inside to think about this. So.
Yeah, we all did though, didn't we? And we did loads of those sort of odd jobs that you just never get round to doing, like whether that's like going through the boxes at the bottom of your wardrobe and you find like family photos, or a friend messages you that you haven't been in touch with for ages. There was something about particularly the first sort of lockdown of the pandemic that people that were I guess maybe it was just the pure time on your hands, but also it was a sort of reflective period, wasn't it? It did allow a bit of time and space to maybe things to just come into your mind.
Yeah, and I hope that we hold on to that stuff. I think that I got a lot out of that in a weird way, which seems kind of fucked to say, but yeah, I don't think we wouldn't have stopped the regular trajectory of our work lives had that not happened. And I think everybody did some soul searching in good ways and bad, and I hope that you take that into the next chapter with you. But I think I'm annoying the guys already, because everything that's happening, I'm like, oh my God, you guys, just hold on to the, look at this moment. And they're like, oh my God. It's like, it's a thumbnail of single art for the internet. Like, why? I'm like, oh, can you believe the third piece of artwork for the fourth album? Oh, and I think that's going to get old pretty quickly. But, you know, I would rather be, I don't know. It made me very conscious that all of this is going to go away, like in all senses of it, like everything from churches to the literal existential stuff. I'm like, none of this is around forever. And I feel like I've definitely not taken advantage, just been blasé about certain things at certain times. And I don't want to do that anymore. So they'll just have to put up with me being like, oh, you guys, our first 5 a.m. flight.
What are your recollections from those first few months of being together in churches? Because was it around the summertime or that you got together 2011?
Yeah, so I met Ian in at the end of September 2011, because he was recording an EP for my old band. I would have been like October time that I did the first like rough recording for what ended up being Churches. And it was that Ian and Martin had been working on these songs together. I think they wanted to try and write songs for other people, maybe try and get publishing. And then when I played with Ian, he was like, oh, maybe it'd be good for her to sing some backing vocals, or it'd make it easier to present to people so it's not just male singing. But yeah, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I don't think any of us really knew. Like, Martin loves to maintain that he knew, like he's the seer. he was like, yes, this is going to be massive. And he was definitely more plugged into like Hype Machine and like what was current at that time in a way that Ian and I just weren't. Yeah, I don't think you can ever really plan any of that stuff. And there's so many things about the band that are just a happy accident. Like, there's so many bands, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but there's so many bands that came out at the same time as us or a few years after that do roughly the same thing, and they they haven't had the same lifespan as us. And I don't know what that is for. I don't know why. I think we're lucky to have an incredibly rabid fan base that was there from the beginning. And I feel like whenever people talk about the resurgence of synth pop and then they list the bands that they're talking about, I'm like, oh, I don't even think about those people as being peers of ours in terms of what we're trying to do or what kind of writing you're doing. I think we were always a lot more focused on emotional content and lyrical content, and I feel like the band has an identity, for better or worse. Some people love us, some people hate us, but most of the time it doesn't seem like there's an in-between, which I kind of think is a positive sign. I would rather be saying something lyrically and literally than just be benign, you know?
That sort of feeds into something I was going to ask you about later on, but we might as well get onto it now, of just that idea of like churches being, just my opinion, but sort of genre fluid, sort of audience fluid, just you do your thing, and like it just seems like different communities of people really get into what you're doing. Like, you know, the obvious examples being, you know, to illustrate that point being that you've been on tour with a whole bunch of diverse artists, from Deftones through to, like, you know, you're going out with Donna Missile later in the year. Like, this is a really diverse sort of group of people that you've worked with and been associated with and collaborated with and stuff. We're all familiar with like the kind of old school way of thinking around the kind of like the boxes that fit neatly over genres and festivals and the way that we consume music, the very titles that we flick through when we go into a record store. And like, it feels like churches could kind of fit into a lot of different ones. And so is that something you intentionally wanted, or you've just been happy that it's emerged in that way?
I think it was just something that was always in the DNA of it, because we all come from rock and alternative band backgrounds. So when we were started to do a quote unquote pop band, there was always going to be like a strange juxtaposition in that. And I think for me, you can always tell when someone's quote unquote going pop because they think it's a smart thing to do, or whether they really love it. And I feel like the thing that always frustrated each of us individually in other bands was that pop was bad and melody was not allowed. And you had to always bury those things, because all of us do love pop music. We can Like, you can love all things at once. Like, you think it's okay. And so when we went into the alternative pop space, I never really fully felt like we fitted there. And I know that that's been frustrating to people around us that work with us sometimes, because it's like, ah, they're not fully accepted by this community, but not fully accepted by that community. And for booking and playlisting and genre, all that stuff, it does feel like we fall between two stools sometimes. But I think in the long run, that's been a real strength for the band, because the day the first album came out, we played a session on Radio 2, and at night we played a boiler room session. And I was like, those are the two most bizarre things. But yeah. I think that's always, yeah. And then once we realized that that was a thing we could do, and you can tell from shows or online that the demographic is pretty broad in terms of age and interests and all those things. So I think once we realized we were allowed to do that, we definitely went into that more. And especially the last few years, like, I personally think it's really great that we can do a collaboration with a big EDM guy, and then we can work with Robert Smith, and we can make a record with Greg Kirsten, and then we can make a record basically over Zoom. I kind of feel like that's a real strength to the band. And I don't really read reviews very much, but I read a review of like one of our shows that we did at Ali Pali, and the premise was like, for a band that's never had a hit, there's a lot of people at this show. And then I was like, yeah, I think that's really cool though, because for us it's always these little like 5%er things rather than like one big smash. It's always like somebody heard you on some TV show or a video game, or their friend found it on SoundCloud when they were at university and then they told them about it. And yeah, I feel like that's something that we're really grateful for and want to invest in terms of like, what does a long-term project look like? What, how do you keep people interested? How do you keep your touring good? How do you stay around? And you're not going to be hot property forever, you know? And I think that's something that we figured out after the second album, was that you're not always going to be everybody's favorite darling kind of thing. But how can you invest in the people that have invested in you and keep evolving, rather than, you know, you don't have to evolve into super mainstream pop to keep moving forward.
How hard is it to not constantly spend time second guessing yourself? Like, listening to you there talking about it, like, presumably the idea is that when you sit down to write some new music, you kind of want to just detach, and you want to retreat to that sort of original essence of what creating music is to you and amongst the three of you in the band. But you've come a long way. Like you said, you've gone on this trajectory that's actually probably been really great for like longevity in terms of like building and you've got like really kind of loyal people that have come with you the whole way. Does it still play on your mind of all those things you just mentioned? There's loads of like competing factors. How do you filter out the noise, or is it even possible to filter out the noise when sort of creating something new?
I think I've done better and worse jobs of that at different times. Like, yeah, when I've heard people comment on the lyrics over the course of time, I think the ones that have connected with people much better are the ones where we are being more vulnerable and we are being more open and honest. And I think there was a time period where I found that quite unpleasant to have to do, because it felt like everything that comes out of my mouth is being analyzed, and why would I give people more rope to hang me with? I don't want people to know any more than they already know, because it's not good for my well-being. But I think that the songs suffered because of that, because they don't need to be even stream of consciousness about yourself, but you need to be putting enough of your own emotion and honesty into a song, no matter who the narrator is, I think. And yeah, I look back on those songs and I'm like, those songs are good, but they don't have the same emotional weight to them, because they, or maybe that's just how I feel about them. I feel like they feel more disconnected because that's what they were designed for. But that's not what people necessarily want our band to be. So if anything, last year felt the most akin to the first album in terms of being in a vacuum. Like, when we made the first album, we'd written most of it before anybody heard the band, really. So you were writing without expectations. And I think that of all the horrible things that happened last year, the band kind of ceased to exist in the truest sense of it. Like, if nobody sees you, nobody hears you, you don't go anywhere, you don't do anything. Does a band exist? If a band tree falls in the woods. So, the band, you know, like the band became, instead of this chaotic, wonderful, chaotic Godzilla that just tramps through our lives, it was like a source of consistency and comfort almost. We would meet up and we would write, and we were just kind of writing for each other, as cheesy as that sounds. We're like, let's just try and make something good. It doesn't seem like this is going to, we'll try, but we don't know what's going to happen. And if anything, I think not having anybody watching or listening and having a mental health break from what is a wonderful but pretty fucking insane job was, I think, helped us a lot in terms of finding a better balance with that. And I think, yeah, the fear of writing personally kind of disappeared for me on this album. So I think that was good. If you, again, you only have a certain amount of time, so you might as well, what's the point? If you only get to put out a certain number of records, you might as well put something on it that you can look back on and be like, yeah, I'll hang my hat on that.
I mean, you mentioned there the importance of switching off, taking a break from it all. Having done that in between the release of the last record and then the start of the pandemic, what did that entail for you? Was that a case of just, was that like turn your phone off in a practical sense? How did you manage to create a bit of distance to give yourself some headspace to be able to start over, to start again, to want to start over again?
I don't know that we did really. Like, I guess the album came out in 2018 and then we toured like mad bastards. And then we put out this EDM collaboration thing in springtime 2019. So then we toured off that for a bit. And then we put out a song for a video game and then we toured off that for a bit. So we only finished in like December, end of December 2019. Then we had the Christmas period, a little bit of time at home. And then we came back to start writing in February 2020. And then everything fell apart, obviously. So I think a lot of the reflecting was done when everybody was fully, fully locked inside their houses and pretty fucking terrified.
Yeah, I mean, those early days were so strange, but like just following the kind of directives of being like, how is today different from yesterday, wasn't it? It was quite confusing and just, yeah, it was terrifying. It was kind of just this thing ripping through the world.
And I think if anything for me, that having spent that time, it was important to reflect on that because a lot of mad stuff happened for us in good ways and bad. And I think sitting reflecting on those things, it was almost like an epiphany where I was like, why am I wasting my fucking time on certain things? Like certain things within the job. I was like I just don't have any fucks to give on those fronts anymore. And I think that we've made better music because of it. And yeah, I think that people are responding better to the music we put out so far because that we just took off these parameters that we put on, if that makes sense. Because everybody will tell you, oh well, we don't mind, we're fine, we'll just make whatever we want, no artist is ever worried. But especially for people like us from where we come from, I'm like, I spent a lot of time, especially around the third album, being really fucking worried that it was all going to go away and it was going to be because I didn't do a good enough job, or like you're kind of told this or sold this idea that it's all going to disappear. There's not enough time. Quickly, quickly. Like, right, you have to do better, bigger, faster. Like, and I don't know that that's true necessarily in terms of making stuff that's actually good in the real sense.
Did that just feel like a momentum of people saying, like, work harder, work harder, work harder? Is that what it feels like? Just tweet more, play more shows, do more TV appearances, more? Like, is that what, like, I guess I'm just trying to get to, like, That pressure that it sounds like was on there, the idea that things might go away and like that somehow the solution was that you've got to keep sprinting. What kind of things were they, and how did you learn to say like enough is enough? Was that almost like one day where you were like, I can't do this. I need to stop doing that.
Well, I think we've been really lucky in terms of the people that we work with have never really been like that with us. Like we were really lucky with who we signed with and all those things. But it is just a fearful pressure from within yourself sometimes. Like, no bands are the same. You should not be comparing yourself to other people. But then it is like, oh, so-and-so is much more engaging with their fan base on the internet, and then their tickets sell better because of that. And then this person did a collaboration with this person, which meant they got this tour support, which made... It's just like, you're just trying to keep your career for as long as you're allowed. And, you know, on the third record, I feel like there was a sense within all of us that were like, okay, well, we can't make the same album again, so we have to do something different. But I don't really know what that is. So I think we went in feeling a bit directionless, and we found what I think is a good direction when we worked with Greg Kirsten, who we ended up working with on that. But I know that a lot of the fan base didn't really like that record that much. And I think I look back on that and I wonder if that was because the lyrics weren't as personal or as emotive. I'm not sure. But for me, I'm like, I don't regret any of those things because I learned so much from working with somebody as crazy talented as that. And if you made this, if we made The Bones of What You Leave part three, people wouldn't have liked that. Like, it wouldn't, you have to grow and evolve as a person, as a writer. You have to try stuff. Like, I don't want to be afraid to try things. So I feel like the only thing I would change about it is that over the course of that album cycle, I think I learned better about listening to my gut about certain things. Because I think, for better or worse, I think I have a good, pretty good sense of what I think. This sounds really big-headed. I have a good sense of what we should be doing. But yeah, I just mean, you know, all three of us, I think we have, but we kind of got psyched out of trusting that, if that makes sense. Your music first becomes popular. People like the honesty of it and what it is, and then you sit and second guess what that is, and you try and focus group out the things that you, and it's just it's endless. So I feel like this was a good time for us to just be like, we need to trust ourselves more. And if anything, I had a conversation with our manager at one point in 2019, and he was like, I understand, I totally get it. And he made a good point to me, and I think about it a lot. He was like, you can say no to all these things and that's totally fine, but if you say no to something, you have to come back with what you do want to do. And I was like, So then I sat and stewed on that. And I was like, how am I supposed to know? I'm not the boss of everything. And then about 3 weeks later, I've been looking through like some archive stuff I had of churches. And I found this list of band names that we were going to call the band. And there was a lot of bad ones, but then Screen Violence was on it, was something we were going to call the band. And I was like, well, that would be, if we're feeling a bit disjointed and unsure, maybe that's just a good writing prompt, because we all love everything from that era. And for me, lyrically, that phrase now means something very different than what it did at the time. So I thought it was just going to be a cool writing prompt for us to all get excited about old movies. And then it kind of evolved into this other thing. And now here we are. So if anything, yeah, it's all part of the journey. If you take one of these blocks away, the whole thing falls down. So I don't really believe in the whole look back and regret thing. Personal life, totally. Professional life, no.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
screen violence and settling on that title and the various meanings, like you just said there, that it sort of collects together, like your love of classic horror movies and like that genre, but then also this sense that we've all just come out of still a lot of us in a period of basically life has been continued via screens, like technology has basically mm-hmm. been the one thing that's allowed to kind of, that has meant that we can sort of stay sort of together in during this period. Starting on the movie side of things, actually, where did your love of horror movies start? Because you worked in a cinema at one point, didn't you?
I did. I worked in two cinemas. I worked in the Cineworld on Renfrew Street in Glasgow, this big multi-story one. And then I worked in theory it's alternative, but still owned by a big company called The Grosvenor in the west end of Glasgow. So
okay.
Yes, I have cleaned up a lot of stuff with spin bags.
I mean, that was very diplomatic though, the way you said cleaned up a lot of stuff, because my brother worked in a cinema when we were teenagers, and yeah, some of the stuff that goes on in the cinema, and also some of the things like, I would never eat a hot dog that's been made in a cinema.
No.
And despite that weirdness, do you have fond memories of working in the cinema?
I really do. Like, if anything, all those just disgusting stories, like there's so many disgusting stories of, like, I remember a couple shagging up the back during like a morning showing of Horton Hears a Who. And I was like, why? This is not what Dr. Seuss would want. I don't know. Maybe he would. I mean, I'm not sure. And more sinister things than that. But I look back fondly on that time because I mean, I did just love movies. I still love movies now. Like, I think for me, it's always been like escaping and storytelling. And I grew up in a pretty remote area where there wasn't a lot to do. So a lot of the escaping that you did was into films, and you would get a bus and then two buses into Stirling so you could go to one of the two screens in the bingo hall. And like, you know, I think that's always been something that's really attractive to me. And Ian and Martin are really big movie heads also, but we all kind of align on that kind of Cronenberg-y John Carpenter world. And I do think you can hear that in the music to a degree because of the synths that come from that time period. And it was always something that we found interesting, and because churches started out specifically using only those synths, that's where the kind of idea for the name came from. So, but we decided at the time, we're like, it's too specifically retro, it's going to make people think that the band is just this retro only project, which wasn't what we wanted. But I kind of like that the idea of what screen violence means to us has evolved since then. Like, it means this aesthetic thing, so that's the horror aesthetic for the album, but the songs aren't concept horror songs, you know, they're about the other parts. I feel like it's always like, when we talk about it, violence on screen, violence through screens, and violence by screens, if that makes sense. Because I feel like this stuff that we're talking through right now is incredible, and it's insane that we're able to do this, but I don't know that technology is great for us emotionally as human beings. And also, I think my relationship with those things as a female, and as a female in the job I have, has been quite tricky at times, to say the least. So I think, and we did surf quite a lot of that wave in 2019. So I think coming into this writing, there's a lot of fodder for the idea of feeling possessed or hunted and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Concepts everywhere.
Selecting one of those, talking about the, like, almost like screen time and our relationship with the internet, and just how that shapes us and the impact it has on our well-being. Early on in the podcast, you mentioned like Hype Machine in relation to like that when you were starting out with the band and like the way that people would kind of discover music and stuff. And instantly the feeling I had in that moment was like, that felt like a bit of a simpler time. it makes you sort of throw back to like the halcyon days of MySpace and Bebo or something. But like that one.
Not thought about that for a while.
Never made it, did it?
Started it, because the whole like, who do you give your daily heart to thing? Yeah. Like, not started it, but that kind of likes culture is weird.
Yeah, and that's just like, it's, you know, it likes culture on acid now with Instagram and everything else. But yeah, have you kind of has your relationship with that reshaped over time? And have you ever been curious about the idea that if we just turned off the internet, what would happen? What would life be like if in 2021 we just turned off the internet for a bit of a break from it all?
Well, I feel like our band has a really specific relationship with the internet, because we came out at such a specific time, as you say. Like, it was SoundCloud and blogs and Hype Machine, and that just doesn't exist in the same way now, I don't think. So yeah, we were like really heavily immersed in the internet from the beginning of the band. But I remember being on an early Churches tour and our manager being like, you guys should get this thing called Instagram. And we were like, oh, okay. And then like putting up a picture of Martin in like a service station in England somewhere. And thinking, I was like, is this how you Instagram? I don't know. So, you know, like, I feel like we've been at the birth of so many of those things, but nobody understood what it was going to be in that, what it would evolve into. And I don't know. My partner doesn't have any social media, and I see the joy that that brings him. So I do think, I don't know, I think if I wasn't in the job I'm in, I don't think I would do it, because I don't use it really. Like, I'll message a friend who replies to something I posted, but I don't use it personally, just because that's not what my relationship is with it. But it's, I do think it's an incredible way to communicate with people, and I, especially for an artist, I'm like, okay, well, it's the only place really that you get to say exactly what you want to say apart from your actual art, you know? Like, if I try and make the Instagram less about pictures of my face from certain angles and use it more as like a mood board, like Pinterest, especially in the run up to the album coming out. I was always like, this is how you kind of set the tone. But the like sculpture is weird, because nobody wants that, really. I'm like, guys, let's make something creative and find a community. And, you know, it is a direct line to your fan base, but even though I know how the sausage is made, I still feel like it makes us all feel terrible about ourselves, especially aesthetically. Like, it's just so bizarre and dark in a lot of ways. And even though I know how long it takes, I'm like, that person took that photo 40 times. And then these are the filters that they put on it. And this is a professional photo that they obviously paid for from a shoot. But when, even if you know that, when you're not in the right mindset and you look at it, it just makes you feel fucking terrible. Like, I have never known more about what's right and wrong with my physical appearance than other than when people tell me on the internet, you know? And I don't, we all think that about ourselves anyway, because of the images that we, the messages that we take in from the world. And then it's just odd that, yeah, I feel like we're in this spinning wheel. I don't know where it's going to end. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like we're in a real kind of pivotal point. I do think there'll be something will happen in the next couple of years whereby, you know, we've got governments and we've got platforms, and they're kind of telling each other that they need to take responsibility for this stuff. And then we've got kind of third parties, you know, people that are on those platforms saying, you know, it's time to do something about this. And it does feel like we're moving towards a point where things will happen. I don't know exactly what, but
yeah, I guess it's just this tricky space, because it's like, oh, if you start pulling at this thread, then you have to pull at this thread, and you have to pull at this one. And I was like, yeah, that's interesting in the conversation around like streaming and things like that. It feels like that conversation is really weighted towards one or two services. And I'm like, but if you hate that, then you're going to have to hate YouTube. And if you hate YouTube, then no more cat videos for you. And like, you know, like, it's just, and I don't know. It's like, why are we mad? Like, I think it's, we're mad at those companies for what they've done to the music industry, but major labels have stakes in those companies. And we're not mad at the music industry for not getting a fucking clue fast. Like, they knew. Like, I've watched enough documentaries on this. I'm like, you basically handed the keys to tech companies because you were being so stubborn about the change that was happening, and you just couldn't see it. And now everyone's annoyed that tech companies control music. But
I think it was,
like, labels are doing fine because they figured out how to get a back end on that, you know.
I think a huge amount of that could be like, it's like, it was like this big pendulum swing that came at like just into the, you know, the millennium came along, and like Napster was there and LimeWire, and basically they just absolutely smashed their hand on the panic button and were like, we've got to go the other direction here. I think the industry is living with the consequences of that period and their reaction to that.
And it is tricky when artists talk about it, because I don't think that setup and that system is correct. But if I was a teenager, I would be overwhelmed. I would be overjoyed because you could have access to so much music. And why is it it's not really your job as a fan to care about why this person is or isn't making money. And I also don't think that you're owed a living from making music. Like, making music is a privilege. And yes, the problem is if other people are making money in a way that you are not. But I think that, yeah, it's never guaranteed. And even 10, 15 years ago, if you were an artist of a certain size, you probably weren't making very much money then either. So, yeah, I guess it's how the pie is broken down is, I think, what's upsetting people. But some of the narrative I do think is strange, because I'm like, well, but none of us are guaranteed that this is a job. We're not unionized in that way. Like, there isn't a daily rate, an hour wage. Like, there just isn't. So I don't, it's a tricky, it's a very tricky thing. It's a hot potato. I don't know how to handle it, and I don't know what's right. And I resign from this conversation.
Yeah, and you're like, let's move on to talking about Robert Smith. I mean, you're going to get asked, obviously, in every single interview you do in the run to this album about working with Robert Smith from The Cure. An amazing, an amazing track, but also what an amazing experience. I read that basically you had approached him to contribute to the track and it went off into the ether and you weren't really necessarily sure whether that collaboration would happen. And then he sent it back and said, "What do you want?" And you said, "I want you to record something for us." And he sent his vocals for the track back on Halloween. That feels very appropriate.
He says it was an accident, but I do wonder. I'm like, maybe he was doing us a service as fans. He was like, this is what I know they want. I'll just do it this way. But yeah, it's beyond, my mind still is like boggled by the fact that happened at all, just because we're all such big fans of The Cure and of Robert's lyrics and his writing and just the way that he has carried himself through his career. Like they've always been completely unique and had such an integrity to it. And yeah, I think that's something that we're always in awe of. And working with him has honestly been the best. He's been the best, easiest, nicest person that we've collaborated with. And that's saying a lot because we've worked with a lot of nice people. So yeah, he's just incredibly engaged and really generous. Like, he's so conscious of not wanting to be treading on what we're doing. And I'm like, tread all over the song, please. And he just, yeah, I think... he was a big one for me. I was like, oh my God, I hope he's not a prick. I really was like, oh, this is going to be so disillusioning if he's a prick. But no, he's generally everything that you would think. And yeah, we're really excited about that. And yeah, I feel it's exciting to see the crossover in the fan bases as well.
Yeah, what's that been like?
Like, I've seen enough Cure shirts at our shows to be like, I think that they will like this.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, for me, I'm like, there's a thread that goes through all these bands. Like, when you mentioned Deftones earlier, I'm like, well, The Cure and Deftones have a connection in a different way.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm like, yeah, it's always this, there's this kind of honesty and emotion and melancholy or something that goes through all those bands and hopefully through our band as well. So yeah, I always like to think about not a scene in a traditional sense, but like a scene in terms of like a tapestry of music that makes sense together. We're trying to get Robert in our scene, basically. We're trying to get into Robert's scene. Yeah, like a tiny version of Robert's career sounds pretty amazing to me.
Yeah. Going back to what we were talking about earlier about kind of managing how your relationship with like the online world, one of my favorite, I don't know whether this is true, but one of my favorite things I'd heard about Robert Smith was that he has got it absolutely sewn up, because he basically does all of his email correspondence on like one day of the week, and basically you know that you're only going to get an email back from Robert Smith on like a Thursday or something. Like, he treats it a bit like fan mail. So like on a Thursday he'll go through all of his emails and say like, yes, I'll do that interview, yes, I'll go on that track. And like I said, it makes a lot of sense.
He doesn't have a smartphone, and he bought like 5 or 6 versions of the same phone at the same time about 10, 15 years ago, because he was like, I know I like this one, which I respect. And then I feel really bad because he's been so generous to us. I'm like, it's like charity outreach for us, because he got FaceTime and Zoom so he could do promo. Like, he hadn't used it at any point in the pandemic. And then he was just like, Span needs my help. I will help them get this interview by doing a FaceTime. And, you know, like most people would not, in his position, wouldn't do that, I don't think. And he'd like self-taped at home the stuff for the music video. He just did it in his house and sent it to us. And he doesn't need to be doing that. But I feel like that sums him up as an artist, or what I would like to think about him as an artist, is that it is about creation and collaboration in the truest sense, you know? And ultimately, that's what we're all supposed to be doing. Like, he said something on an interview the other day which got me a little misty, but then I'm like, I was already a crier. 2020 pushed me into the stratosphere. Like, there's no coming back for me now. But what he said was, the interviewer had been like, oh yeah, it must be difficult to not be constantly working on a track because, you know, your work is right there all the time. And then he immediately was like, but music's not work. He was like, this is work. Other things around facilitating your right to make music is work, but actual making of music is not work, and I don't ever think about it like that. And I was like, I feel like that's, may we all be more like that, I think.
Yeah, the take the wisdom from Robert Smith. I think he's, yeah, I mean, he's always struck me as like a really generous spirit and also really straight talking, which I've always sort of, as a fan, appreciated. Totally. And I also love the fact that maybe he's walking around with sort of five Nokia 3210s in his pocket, just like, I like this one. It's easy. I like the texting on this one.
And he's smart, because then there's no even temptation of any of the things that we've just been talking about, because you're safe from the devil, because the devil's not inside your phone.
Exactly. We probably haven't got time to kind of go in and sort of talk about lots of kind of individual songs on the album, but I particularly like Good Girls. I think it's an amazing track. And I like the line that you have in there talking about, well, you reference like killing your idols and this idea of kind of that's a chore and it's difficult, but almost maybe potentially kind of a necessary thing. And I was wondering whether that was just a reference to some of the sort of habits and attitudes that go along with much older generations and how like in time they will disappear. And maybe that makes you feel a bit hopeful about what the sort of your generation and generations below you, the kind of world that they might create.
Yeah, well, I guess the opening line came, I had written it down in my notebook after a lengthy pub discussion with friends about certain musicians who've been doing certain things. And I guess I feel like the concept of cancel culture has really evolved and snowballed and almost now been weaponized by the right. And I don't know that that's necessary. I feel like accountability culture makes more sense in a lot of ways, but it's not as catchy, it's not as clickbaity. And also a lot of things that people are getting quote unquote cancelled for, there's another name for a lot of those things. If you're getting fired from a workplace for doing a certain thing, that's not cancel culture, that's abuse. So but I sat and listened to this thing, and then I just had this kind of quiet rage where I was like, yeah, but isn't it a privilege to sit and talk about that? Talk about whether what this person has done is hurtful, to talk about whether this person is an abhorrent racist, or talk about whether this person is abusing women, because it doesn't affect you. It doesn't affect your life. And I just, that, like, it just made smoke come out of my ears. I was just like, I don't understand why you would go to such lengths to make excuses for Woody Allen. Like, things like that. I'm like, I just don't get that. Like, and they almost get more annoyed at the people who are pointing out the thing than they do at the man that's done it. And it's mostly always a man, let's be honest. But not that women can't be terrible, especially white women. We can be really fucking shit. But it was just interesting sitting thinking about it, being like, yeah, but whether, for me as a listener, I find it difficult to listen to somebody's art, especially like the narrator of the song or the writer of the film, if I know that the same brain that this came from is the same brain that could feel something so hurtful and violent and aggressive. And I don't know. And I understand that you're never going to agree with somebody on everything. You can't expect all your favorite artists to think exactly the same way as you. But I feel like as a listener, there's like a giving over of control and the vulnerability when you're sharing in that with somebody. And I don't want to share in Woody Allen's art with him. It doesn't mean that he's not made some profound art, but I don't want to share in that. I would find it difficult to listen to Morrissey in the present day. Like, you know, it's just certain things that you know, and everyone feels differently about it, but I do feel like a lot of people are able to feel differently about it because they come from a place of such protection where the discussions around those things are hypothetical for them. I just, instead of flipping the bar table and leaving, I was like, I'm going to see them that later. And then, you know, and I think I was the only woman involved in that conversation because, you know, I have a pretty heavy male friendship group and pretty heavy male work group because of the profession I work in. And I was just interesting to sit and listen to people talk about it. And I was like, but a lot of people don't have that luxury. As a woman, I don't feel like I have that luxury in terms of making excuses for Louis C.K., even though I have heavily enjoyed Louis C.K.'s comedy at times. I don't feel comfortable making excuses for that man so I can continue to enjoy his comedy. Like, it's just, it's not abstract for me in the way that it's abstract for other people that were in that chat. So, but I promise it's a fun pop song. You know, we made the chorus hooky. we made the chorus fun.
Yeah, it is an amazing song. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's about what you just described there is the classic case of kind of real privilege as well, of just like maybe, yeah, being in that sort of male dominated environment of them kind of just being more passive about the subject. And yeah, I'm super glad that you've written about it, because I think it will have a real impact.
Thanks, man. I'm excited for the men on the internet.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, just get out your battle armor and just like your thicker skin, because I think like, yeah, fuck those guys.
Yeah. Well, and I think that was what's been interesting about it for me, is because I don't actively believe that I spend a lot of time with any men who would think any of those things in a different setting. But when it comes to defending the art of artists that they love, they will definitely go to really extreme lengths to explain away those things. And I think it's because you love the art, you don't love the artists. But I think for me, I can't ever divorce those
things.
I find it difficult. And also, yeah, even like financially and emotionally supporting somebody that has done that, I'm like, that's just, I choose not to do that. I'm not saying that person needs to be disappeared to the top of a mountain forever, but do I want to go see that person in concert and listen to what they have to say and emotionally connect with them? Not really.
Like your way of making your point is to, yeah, not consume that art. I'm not going to support that person. I don't agree with what they've done. Like,
yeah, and it doesn't mean that I need to violently assault that person verbally on the internet or any of those things. I'm like, I just don't need to participate in that because I don't want to be contributing to that as a worldview or something. I don't know. That sounds privileged as well, doesn't it? See, I'm part of the problem.
Oh, no, I mean, we could send ourselves in endless circles. That's how these things are so difficult to unravel. My final question, just quickly, was really just about like the practicals of how you've worked the last like 18 months, because the majority of this record that's coming out was made remotely. Has it made you think, you know what, in the future, we could make albums remotely? Or has the experience made you think, you know what, we did that. We did a really practical thing. We made it work. And next time I would love to get back in the studio together.
I think we were lucky that we had quite a lot of the rough demos before we had to separate. So at least the structure of them existed in some way, whether that was just a demo that Ian and Martin had from previously, or I think the only things that we'd recorded vocals on before Ian had to leave was He Said, She Said and Good Girls were like the two first things that had happened. All the rest of the lyrics were written remotely. And I think I can write lyrics remotely and the guys can do production remotely, but that's because the structure is already in place. Right. I think if we had to work and like write and create songs over Zoom, that would be really a lot more difficult, because there is something about the energy of being in a room and like the speed that you can communicate with somebody when you're in a room and you're like, no, not that sound. What about this? And that's just much harder on Zoom. And I think it was a really special way to make a record and a really special way to stay connected. But I think by the time we all get out of here, I think we're all going to be very grateful for this technology, but very happy to not have to use it as much again.
Yeah. And it would be nice to wrap up a song and then say, should we have a drink?
Yeah. Should we like hang out rather than, and the time zone was a real sticker as well, because it would mean that one of us would have to be up till stupid o'clock in the morning or getting up at stupid o'clock in the morning all the time. And I think that brings a different energy to your writing, but It's just, yeah, you're never in the same emotional state as one, at least one person in the group, because you're just not in the same,
you're
not having the same life at that moment.
To find previous episodes of Midnight Chats, simply search your podcast app. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to keep up, as they're published every week at midnight. For more information on the music magazine that makes this series, visit loudandquiet.com.
Anyway, good night.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Because there's nothing like a weekend pause with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.